Hi, good morning, and welcome to the plenary session. My name is Ed Burns.
Hi.
My wife. And hello to Dr. Ruth Freed and her hundreds of biology groupies here. Welcome from Central. There's always this sort of perfunctory statement that it's an honor and privilege to introduce the speakers. Mostly, they read it. It's an honor and a privilege to introduce the speakers. But as my wife and I are both Holocaust survivors' children, and my mother went through a selection with Dr. Mengele, so this particular session has tremendous, tremendous deep resonance for both of us. It's a rather interesting pairing. We have Irene Ismay, survivor and victim of Dr. Mengele, with us. We have Ramosha Tendler, a world-renowned Rosh Yeshiva and expert on Jewish medical ethics. Why is this apparent? Well, it turns out that many of you know that observant Jews are Makabel Olam Shemayim, that we accept halacha in every part of our life. And I think what this morning's session will demonstrate is that halacha is a must for guiding the principles of people who think they are ethical, but may not be. Dr. Grodin pointed out the fact that not only was medical experimentation an aspect of the Nazi regime, but it also occurred at least eugenics in the United States as well. United States, Americans, good people, they're not these beasts of the Nazi regime. How could this have happened? Well, unfortunately, there was a very sorry history in the United States as well. Dr. Grodin mentioned the fact that after the Nazi doctors' trial, there were the Nuremberg Code of Human Experimentation came out. That was 1945. And that demonstrated to the world that in order to do human experimentation, one needs to have informed consent without coercion, one needs to avoid physical and mental suffering, and that there be no expectation of injury or death. And that was 1945. Yet in the United States of America, from 1930 to 1972, the infamous Tuskegee study that was developed by the United States Public Health Service occurred in our American Great United States, where 600 African-American males were followed for syphilis and to see them degenerate into neurosyphilis and death, even though penicillin was discovered in 1940 to be curative of syphilis. So having codes, being good people, it's not enough. We need to be makabel, the essence of what Olam HaShemayim is, what medical halacha is. Despite Christopher Hitchens and God is not great and God is dead, we do need a God, we do need a Torah. And that's the juxtaposition of today's two speakers. We're going to hear first from Ms. Irene Ismay. Irene is here with her brother Renee. Both of them were victims of the Holocaust, victims of medical experimentation. They hail from Czechoslovakia. They were taken to Theresienstadt and then to Auschwitz, where they met up with the infamous Dr. Mengele. I refer you to the biographies in your handouts for both Ms. Ismay and my Rebbe. Rabbi Tendler was a world-famous expert both in medical halacha, Rosh Yeshiva Reitz, the author of numerous texts on Jewish medical ethics. Please read the biographies, get the extended story. Let me introduce Ms. Ismay.
I'm a little nervous. Today I will tell you a tale of horror that not many have heard, a tale barely covered in Holocaust literature, at Kale that many survivors know nothing of. A tale of the twins who survived Auschwitz. A tale of a Holocaust within the Holocaust. It happened long ago in a place called Auschwitz-Birkenau, where the angel of death, Joseph Mengele, stood on a ramp and made life and death decisions with the flick of the hand. To the left, immediate death in the gas chambers. To the right, a protracted existence of starvation, forced labor, and medical experimentation. Few names are more infamous than Joseph Mengele. Educated, elegant, erudite, a lover of poetry and classical music, a healer turned exterminator. Born in 1911, he held degrees in medicine and anthropology. He studied gypsies, dwarves, people with genetic anomalies, but his all-encompassing passion was the study of twins. And so, the twins became the most exclusive club in the world, handpicked to be human guinea pigs in Mengele's obsessive search for perfecting and reproducing a master Aryan race. Auschwitz provided Mengele with twins in quantities never before available to a scientist at one time, and he was in complete control. He was both our demon and savior. We were spared death as long as we were useful to him. In 1985, the surviving twins who survived Mengele's pseudo-scientific experiments held a mock trial in Jerusalem in front of a distinguished tribunal chaired by Gideon Hausner, chief prosecutor at the Eichmann trials. Powerful people and governments helped Mengele escape after the war. That he lived a life of freedom until his death brings shame to the world. These are some of the testimonies that I heard over the 3-day period. Obviously, the most horrendous experiments were not spoken about because the people were no longer alive. 3,000 twins entered Auschwitz. On Liberation Day, some 170 were still alive. Otto and Frank were 13 years old when they came from Hungary in 1944 with their mother, aunt, and older sister. Their mother and aunt were sent directly to the gas chamber. Experimental injections left Frank with impaired kidneys, and he had to be on dialysis. In 1986, a transplant was made available. Perhaps too late, for he passed and sent his soul up to heaven a few days later. Helen and Pearl were 22-year-old twins from Hungary and came in the summer of 1944. They sat naked for hours of comparative measurements and were injected with chemicals that made them simultaneously very cold, very hot, and nauseous. Their work assignment was piling up dead bodies in a warehouse. To maintain their sanity, they made believe they were stacking sacks of potatoes. Vera told how Mengele was determined to change her brown eyes to blue because she had beautiful blonde hair. She sustained many injections into her eyes that nearly left her blind. Ephraim, also from Hungary, testified that he and his older brother managed to pass themselves off as twins. They endured painful operations on their vocal cords because Mengele wanted to know why only one so-called twin had a beautiful voice. Only Ephraim survived, and in 1967, he had to have his vocal cords removed. In 1984, a special microphone, ironically made in Germany, provided him with a speaking voice. Ruth, not a twin, arrived pregnant with her first child at age 19, December 1943. Somehow she was able to hide her pregnancy because otherwise she would have been sent directly to the gas chambers. When she gave birth to a little girl, Mengele ordered her breasts tied because he wanted to see how long a baby could live without food. She tried to feed the baby chewed up bread moistened with water, but the baby grew weaker and weaker and weaker. On the seventh day, Mengele came to her and said, "Tomorrow I will have the both of you." Knowing that this was a death sentence, Ruth became hysterical. in the hope that Mengele would lose interest in the mother if the baby were dead, a compassionate Jewish doctor brought Ruth a syringe with morphine. After much talking and encouraging all night, Ruth's baby could not survive, but that she at least should stay alive. In the morning, Ruth injected her little girl. Stephanie and Annetta, identical twin girls, age 19, came from Theresienstadt, December 1943. Beautiful girls, they were stripped naked and paraded in front of the SS and the Nazi guards. They had a blood transfusion from identical twins, which made them very sick with a high fever. Somehow they lived, and now Mengele was preparing them for a diabolical fertilization experiment. With identical twin males to see if they would get pregnant with twins. Thankfully, this was thwarted with the imminent arrival of the Russian troops in January 1945. Vera and her twin sister came with their mother and father at age 5 in December 1943. Their elderly father was sent immediately to the gas chamber. The mother remained with the girls. The twins were placed in a cage like animals for 10 days and were given injections and drops into their eyes. A supervisor in the gypsy camp testified how twins were sewn back to back like Siamese twins. All the scars filled with pus and the children scream day and night. The mother finally obtained some morphine and put them out of their misery. These testimonies, so painful, stirred the world, and at long last, a massive hunt for Mengele began, which ended abruptly when a skeleton found in Brazil was proclaimed to be Joseph Mengele in June 1985. Renee, my twin brother and I were born in Czechoslovakia on the first day of winter, December 21, 1937. This sealed our fate, as it sealed the fate of all Jewish children born in 1930 to 1944. In the middle of the night, the Gestapo came to take away our father. He was executed in Auschwitz, December 18, 1941. Our mother received a note that he had succumbed to pneumonia. Renee and I were sent with our mother to Theresienstadt, September 1942. This camp was set up by the Nazis as a model camp to fool the world about their intentions towards the Jews. On a bitter cold night with snow everywhere, Renee and I, on either side of Mother, clutched her clothing lest we be blown by the fierce wind to the cattle car that would bring us to Auschwitz, December 16, 1943. 6 days to our sixth birthday. Dogs ferociously barked. Rifle shots were fired. People fell to the ground and lay still. The train ride so nauseating, suffocating, standing room only. Packed like sardines. No food, no water, no toilets, only lower extremities visible to me. When the train finally stopped and the doors flew open, people just tumbled out. There were many SS men giving directions where to go and yelling, "Raus, raus, schnell, schnell." We were housed together with other Czech families in a special barrack known as the Czech Familian Lager. 3 months later, we were brutally torn from our mother as a soul-piercing cry rent the heavens. As children, we did not understand. But the abyss of that moment still lives in our hearts. That night, the entire lager, 3,800 people, were sent to the gas chamber. A handful of twins, some doctors, and nurses, the only survivors. Just parted from our mother, Renee and I were separated from each other and suffered this additional anguish. We missed the emotional support and companionship provided to twins of the same sex as they were together. Therefore, Renee and I have very different memories. You might say it was good to be a twin in Auschwitz. We were spared immediate death, but our days were filled with fear and trepidation of visits to Mengele. We were hungry, we were cold, we were bedraggled, we were disheveled, we were lonely. We watched shootings, we watched hangings, we watched brutal beatings, just part of the heinous crimes perpetrated. My memories are sporadic. They weave in and out of my daily existence. They stab me, reduce me to tears, make no sense to me. They intrude when I least expect them. The Holocaust is part of my being. No matter the passage of time, nor my efforts to put it aside. These are the things I cannot forget. Please remember, Renee and I were only six. I cannot forget our first visit with our mother to Mengele. I was worried Renee would cry. I'm the older sister, he was the crybaby. I cannot forget the high barbed wire fence with watchtowers. I cannot forget the acrid smell of burning flesh that permeated everything. Dark gray clouds hovered above. The sun did not shine in Auschwitz. I cannot forget being hungry and cold. An older girl had a little drawstring pouch in which she kept her bread, and I so wished that I could have one too. I tried to save my bread for the morning, only to discover that it was gone. Black bread, some liquid, an occasional pack of margarine are all the food I remember eating. I cannot forget standing naked outside in the cold for inspection before going into the showers. And somehow I had a necklace that I was trying to hide. I cannot forget watching people run into the electrified fence and laying still. I cannot forget intermittent rifle fire, air raid sirens, the drone of airplanes, bombs falling. I cannot forget the terror that engulfed me when I lost my way back to my bed after going to the latrines one night. I cannot forget wanting to disappear. I spoke to no one. Once I hid among dead bodies. I cannot forget the visits to the doctor and the many days in the hospital. Blood taken from my neck and fingers, lying on a steel cold table, many injections, x-rays, electrical wires. I cannot forget being hidden under a nurse's skirt during some commotion in the hospital. I cannot forget hearing a great explosion and watching the fire rise to the heaven across the way where the men's barracks were, and worried about Renee. I cannot forget the one moment I saw Renee across the barbed wire fence. Our eyes met. It was just a look. It's a twin thing. But we knew somehow that someday we would be together again. A visceral memory for Renee to this day is that towards the end, another doctor ordered the younger twin boys onto a truck to be taken to the gas chamber. Outraged that another doctor would have the audacity to over-direct him, Mengele overruled the doctor and stopped the procession. But can you imagine the sheer terror that must have gripped these young boys, knowing that they were about to die? Renee was one of those boys. At age 6, we really had no comprehension of what was happening. We had no frame of reference. This is the way we thought life was. This was our life. After liberation, Renee and I continued on our separate paths and were finally reunited in 1950 and adopted here in America. Until 1985, we never spoke about what happened. Therapy was not in vogue. Today, psychologists know that the younger the child, the more severe the trauma. Our most impressionable years were filled with unspeakable horror. and the intervening years have not erased these memories of our lost childhood. 67 years later, I am 73. Loneliness still overwhelms me. I never feel I belong. I cannot buy anything German. I prefer stale breads. My kids make fun of me. Electrical things terrify me. Illness is unacceptable. Hospitals are out of the question, and doctors are my worst nightmare. We live in an age of explosive knowledge in medicine and technology that far exceeds our ethical abilities, and we have been given power that we are not yet prepared for and may never be. Science and technology are intrinsically neutral in character, but they can be used for bad or good. How it is directed is up to all of us, all of society, to discuss and evaluate. So to the students, I know medical school can be grueling, probably worse than boot camp. Don't let them leach out the humanity in you. Remember what brought you to this profession in the first place. You always have a choice to do the morally correct thing. You must have humanism, empathy, self-awareness. Never forget the human soul. Thank you.
Careful. observing you, look at that beautiful lecture on what was online. I'd like to repeat. I think it was at the trial. One of the defense motions was that there was no universal code of ethics at that time. That, of course, is not true. Experiments led to a Nuremberg Code. Nuremberg Code, 1949. What it said was everything we wanted to say. You cannot hurt a fellow human being. You cannot do anything against his will. Everything has become part of general mental ethics today. That was repeated by the Declaration of Helsinki, 1964. Modified in 1975 in Tokyo, in 1983 in Venice, in 1989 in Hong Kong, all basically the same thing. In the year 2000 in Edinburgh, these are universal laws now, signed by all nations, medical ethics. U.S. Department of Health and Human Resource Services, as it was called then, in June 23rd, 2005, emphasized the importance of institutional review boards to make sure that everyone is doing everything they're supposed to do. The Bellman report somehow seems to be favored by all. The U.S. Department of Health, they always cite that as their work, nothing more than the Nuremberg Code, spelling out respect for persons, beneficence to do only good, justice to treat everybody equally. So what happened? You must remember the date, Nuremberg, 1949. Okay? How effective has these ethical codes been? Everybody signed up. No nation was left out. I can spend the rest of the afternoon listing analyses of approved medical research. Medical research involving human experimentation. Mention just a few of them. I'll go back to this in a minute. We mentioned by Professor Burns already, in 1932, a 40-year experiment studying the ravages of syphilis. I'll come back to that in a few moments. From 1944 to 1974, 16,000 patients were used in secret government, USA government-sponsored experiments to determine the effect of radiation on the human body. Many of these patients were children. They knew nothing about the experiments that were going on to them. 1949, Nuremberg Code. This is 1944 to 74. In 1956, here, I want to show you the complexity of medical research today. An experiment was done, known as the Willebrook experiment, which led to a successful vaccine, the hepatitis vaccine. But it was done in Willebrook on children who were severely mentally damaged. They were given the hepatitis virus, caused them to have hepatitis. It led to a successful vaccine. The so-called consent forms that parents signed were confusing. No one looked upon it today as adequate. I would like to defend that experiment for you, give you an idea of the complexity. Every child who entered Willebrook came down with hepatitis. I was there. I visited Willebrook. The children were playing with feces. These were severely mentally challenged children. Everyone, 100%, came down with hepatitis. So a experiments sponsored by NYU Medical School decided they think they have a vaccine now that could protect the children. And the way to do it is to inject the children with the virus, inject the children with the vaccine. Proper approval was not obtained from parents. Children certainly couldn't give approval. But he who have the dilemma. I'm convinced, the researcher said, I'm not hurting the child. Within 3 weeks, he'll come out hepatitis anyway. I'll give it now. I can even set up my experiment. I'll give some of the children the hepatitis vaccine. Some of them I will not give the hepatitis vaccine. And we'll see in a short time whether the children who receive the vaccine, whether they will be protected or not. How do you decide? Should you do such an experiment or not? Here we're moving away from clear evil to potential good, and you're in the middle. That's the kind of dilemma that faces ethical physicians today. I don't know if you can read that what I have up here, but I want to focus, give you an idea of evil that can be done here in this great country of America. I don't like to say bad things about America. Baruch Hashem, my great-grandchildren are six generations of Americans. America has been very good to us. He who have an experiment, no one knows all the details. I studied this experiment as I did the hepatitis one. An experiment that outlived Nuremberg. In 1966, this experiment was presented to the NIH, or then called the NIH, and they reapproved to continue the experiment until 1972, when a little girl, a reporter at the local newspaper, heard from her boyfriend about the experiment, who was working then on the in the experiment. Both experiments, some 600 black indigent patients suffering from syphilis. Decision was to see, understand the course of the disease until the final end. But in the middle, penicillin came on the market. And penicillin was a cure for the disease. So it was reviewed by the NIH and they reapproved to continue the experiment. In 1997, the government formally apologized for the unethical study. President Clinton delivered the apology and compensation was given to the survivors. How could such an experiment have been done here in America? No answer to that. The answer is that possible, I didn't try to say for you, Hashem saw that the wickedness of man was great upon the earth, as we read yesterday, that every thought of his heart was evil, and Hashem reconsidered having made man. The potential for evil exists, how we can rationalize evil. Numerous other examples. Of unethical research. A New Zealand study began in 1966. Almost a copy of the Tuskegee study. But there, they were studying cervical carcinoma. And patients, again, poor, indigent, were used in the experiment, which was nothing more than not to treat those patients and follow the course of the disease. Some of them could have been cured by relatively simple surgery.
experiment. I mentioned before, involving 16 countries, U.S. citizens never told being exposed to radiation or different levels of radiation. Some of you remember Desert Storm. I led a group of 200 students then to enter soil, beginning in the Iraq War, and the soldiers were protected, quote, against unknown biological agents that they thought they could be exposed to, thinking that Iraq had those agents, and they were given vaccines against their will. Those who refused to take the vaccine were expelled from the army, some were imprisoned. Vaccines that later proved to be totally more worthless. Someone decided the danger that these army men are facing for being possibly exposed to biological warfare was worth the risk. Since they're in the army, if you're in the army now, you do what you're told. Decision was not made by a Nazi doctor who wanted to hurt, by an individual who couldn't balance this good, bad, middle road that allows you to choose, but you cannot forget the universal ethic. Universal ethic is you are not in charge of man. You are not the master of man. And therefore, autonomy reigns. A person cannot be compelled to do something against his will. I mentioned the hepatitis experiment, the Willowbrook experiment, something that I don't have on here. In Science, August 31, 2012, only just 2 months ago, a promising hepatitis C drug was struggled. Hepatitis C, a dangerous silent disease today. Only recently, relatively recently, did the doctors get a handle on that disease, identify the virus, and much work is being done to try to find a vaccine for it, or a cure for it. 160 million people worldwide are infected with hepatitis C virus. And the drug would show wonderful promise in animals was used on 250 patients. Was it reported in Science end of August that the drug had to be removed from experimentation because of serious toxicity. Several patients died, many suffered heart failure. How did that happen? That's what research is. No, it's not. Couldn't find anyone to test the drug. Only 250 of them. If you could have found 250, you could have found 2, 3, and 4. We don't like to publish on experimenting with 4 patients. But experimenting with 4 patients gives you some ideas sometimes. And 8 patients, so. How did they start an experiment with 250 patients? Someone is misreading what is called ethical human experimentation. And that's part of the problem today. What we need is an understanding of what it means to endanger a fellow human's life. The mitzvah of saving a life does not justify danger to a life. We come to it in a minute. I'll mention it now. You're all familiar with that problem which our logic deals with. Namely, how much danger should I accept in order to save you from death? Famous case of two people walking in the desert. One has a canteen of water, the other one does not. Should they both drink and both die? Or should one have the canteen of water, drink, and let us go? The case is not well understood by those who study the matter.
Is that there's a possibility that both should live?
There are searchers. They're making an oasis along the road someplace. Maybe they'll make it to it. It's not that someone sets up a situation where if I don't do this, I'll die anyway. No. It could be that both will survive. But there's danger. The one who has a canteen need not accept the danger that he may die in order to save someone else from certain death. That's the halacha.
Those who want to know, famous Machlokes, Yerushalmi and Babli. Yerushalmi says, you are supposed to share the water.
The Babli says, no, we pass like our Akiva. That's the law that we have today. That's the total law. That applies to all human experimentation. Human experimentation, you'll see soon, involves volunteers. Should you volunteer or not is the basis of whether it's ethical or not. The first side issue, which is critical, especially after hearing the presenter this afternoon, can you use the data that was obtained? The Germans were very methodical. They wrote everything down. We have all records. The experiments they did on humans couldn't be done again, but it's done already. Should we not make use of whatever data there was? Number one, I want to make it very clear. Those who study the data are convinced it is valueless data. It didn't even serve the purpose of a medical experimentation. It was designed to kill Jews, nothing else. The few experiments that had some merit, like high altitude experiment, the cold water immersion experiment, they are the ones that have been under a serious ethical evaluation. Should they be published or not? And here, cited the quote from the most authoritative source of information that we have today, the commentator. In 1989, I was interviewed by the commentator after speaking at Stern College, that he was, when the lecture was held, in which I presented the point of view that is forbidden to make use even of data that could be of value to medicine today. That data obtained with such evil should not be available, should not be honored, should not be recognized as the product of a human mind. Most ethicists there have concurred with that decision. I cite over here the statement of Beecher, who did some marvelous work in medical ethics. Even if suppressing the data would be a loss to medicine, then this loss would be far less important than the far-reaching moral loss to medicine that the data thus obtained would be published. There has to be a moral abhorrence to evil. I don't want to come near it. I don't want to touch it. I want to hear about it. Honor those people to put their name into scientific literature would be a dishonor to those they put to death. He presents now the kind of work that goes on today. Most likely more here at this institution and Shiva's Habitual Holland with its Yeshiva University Association there. We need to answer the questions that are on the table today. We have to do medical research. We have to supervise medical research. It should be our PI, however. How do you make these decisions? And then, who should volunteer for clinical research? First, I'd like to differentiate between two groups of potential volunteers. Healthy volunteers, as you see, that are used in phase one clinical studies, and patients with disease. In phase one clinical studies, this is one concerns the work of the drug house living. We pay people to allow themselves to be experimented. The assumption is that those who are doing the experiment are careful, but they know there is a danger. So how do you overcome the danger? You pay the people. It's voluntary. And Lilly is well known. They have a whole organization that searches out volunteers. Temptation is because they give real money. Is it fair to use as patients, as experimenting adults, only those who need money? If they stop you and ask you to volunteer, they'll offer you $1,000. You won't be tempted. Offer you $100,000, you may be tempted. But they get people to come for $100, and for $200, for $300. So who are they appealing to? A socioeconomic class, so they are basically what? Offering them money in a coercive way. They need the money. I don't give it to you unless you do what I ask you to do. That's one level of experimentation. There's a second level of experimentation done on patients who are sick. Today, people suffering from cancer. The doctor, you go to Memorial Hospital, they're busy with research, as our other hospitals, I assume Albert Einstein as well. And they ask them, you know, I have a new drug. Yeah, I give you a consent form, which usually is lengthy, a little bit intimidating, and very often it's offered to the patient just soon after the doctor delivers the diagnosis. You know, I'm sorry, but you have disseminated cancer. You have metastatic disease. And therefore, we have a treatment that we use, but I have also a new treatment. Would you like to enter the trial? Some will get the old drug, some will get the new drug. And sometimes the doctor will tell the patient, I'm asking you, but I don't think any drug will be of value to you. I think your disease is so advanced that I don't think it'll be a value to you. In most instances, dealing with intelligent people, the person is willing to sign the consent. Why? The doctor said that most likely will not be a value to me. But yet, there's always that hope. You give me a drug that may be a value to somebody. Who says it may be a value to me too? So there is always a question, why did he volunteer? Is it because he loves humanity and therefore wants to be in the service of humanity? Or is it because he is being psychologically coerced? Even the doctor didn't do anything wrong. But that's the reality. That's what experimentation is today. I tried to analyze, should a yeshiva bacha agree to an experiment? Problems are often, when he is in the service of humanity, we have taught. Yet the...
Can you make it one more?
Oh, yeah.
The basis of medical ethics is in four verses in the Torah. The first verse says, I emphasize just the words we need, but Apo Yerape, a doctor has permission to heal. Nitin Lushusa Ope Rapos. I mean, God made him sick. What kind of chutzpah do you have? Are you going to make him well? It's none of your business. That's God's business. Rabbi, Yerape, you're a doctor. I ask you cure. If you don't go to a doctor, God won't help you. If you go to a doctor, the doctor won't help unless you and the doctor say to him also. You still need to come home. You're not substituting for God. That's the first verse. The second verse, right there, tells you you have to be careful of your own health. The Shvatim are over the association. You can't go ahead and do skydiving. You can't go ahead and speed when speeding endangers you. You cannot go ahead and smoke. You violate a mitzvah in the Torah. Then comes the third verse. Vashemosolo. I'm not sick, someone else is sick. If he lost his wallet, I have to return his wallet. If he lost his health, I have to return his health. But I don't know how to return his health. I'm not a doctor. A wallet, I know how to return. I know how to return his health. Comes the last verse. The Talmud says, don't stand idly by. You're not a doctor. You can't help him. Hire a doctor to help him. In that verse, we have a commitment to make others well. In my opinion, that includes the moral obligation to volunteer for, quote, a safe medical experiment that can help others. Many things we volunteer for. Volunteer to give someone money to buy food. Volunteer to give someone money so he can educate his children. That's also part of a public welfare. Here we have a mitzvah that's included in the mitzvah. If you can show me an ethical experiment, meaning my danger has been now reduced to the minimum. For if the danger is significant, then that other statement comes in. The statement, I think we have it, Chayev HaKonu.
That's the one before, I think.
The last verse, Chayev HaKonu Chayev HaKonu. Last night, I have a son who sits on the board of the Mount Sinai Hospital in Baltimore. He also says the Dafyomi in the shul. He called me up and something has just happened that may be of interest to me. Right? And that is, I didn't get a chance to put it on because my computer only knows how to do email. I don't know anything else about doing email. So I'll read you what he said to me. Maryland Shock Trauma seeks community consent on blood plasma study. And immediately, they already have a quote from two ethicists that is an amoral experiment. What's the experiment? People have been brought in, it's a major trauma center, Mount Sinai Hospital there. People have been brought in, they are unconscious. They are bleeding. We have to now give them a blood transfusion. Nobody uses whole blood. Do you take the blood and break it up into components? We have plasma, platelets, red blood cells. What mixture is the best? The army uses 111. Half plasma, half of the other two blood elements. So the trauma center wants to set up an experiment with W111, W121, 112. Is that an ethical experiment or not?
The patient cannot be asked. The patient is unconscious, bleeding to death. I would like to suggest that's a perfectly moral, ethical experiment without consent of the patient. There are sometimes with my mitzvah to save a life takes precedence over the individual's autonomy. For basically his autonomy is also that he wants to live. And therefore what I'm doing really is with what? Automatic consent. So this study requires, this way they set it up, if you don't like this analysis, you have to wear a wristband that says, I opt out. I don't want to be involved. So in case you caught a real accident, they shut you in, but you'll not be involved in the experiment. I cite this as the need for ongoing analysis. First, by the medical scientists to learn to respect human life to an extent that you minimize the risk to another human being to a point where you're willing to take the risk yourself. In the old days, doctors who experimented used themselves first. And second, understand the halacha in each and every case. That they have an appreciation for the medical facts, an appreciation for some of the, if you're fancying yourself, today we have tremendous things going on. Mentioned the whole genome analysis, genomics, which is impacting our medicine. We want now personalized medicine. Go and analyze your genome. I'll be discussing that at a later time. What are the consequences? In fact, there'll be an article on the yeshiva auspices that will appear the first week of November in the Jewish press that speaks this whole genome and the ethical consequence. The need to have people who are trained in halacha and understand the scientific basis, that's the part of the universal code of ethics that we have to establish. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Tendler. Thank you, Ms. Hesney. We're now going to repair to the Weisberg Commons in the Belfer Building, and everybody's invited to partake of lunch. The program will resume in a moment. Thank you.
So much, Harry. It's fantastic.
Amen. In the case of the Baltimore proposal, does this mean they were not satisfied with the current protocol of 111?
We don't know.
There could be better.
Do they have reason to think why it could be better? Well, they have reason.
But why? Because they're not succeeding in keeping the patient alive.
Oh, so it doesn't always, in other words, the 111 doesn't always work.
The army side of 111. So?
Is this a Chayeshah question also?
What you're doing is you're giving the person life. You're giving red blood cells to carry oxygen.
Right.
I think 121 is better. Get more red blood cells. So, oh no, red blood cells too much.
Sim.
Recording, have I